It's good to see all of you here. The scripture reading will be there in a moment. You may turn to Hebrews 11 if you would like, as where the scripture reading will be. We will not stay there, however. But you can turn there if you like. On a personal note, before I begin, as I said to the adult class, and now I say to all of you, I appreciate all of your notes, all of your prayers, all of your messages, emails, texts, however you chose to communicate with us while we were gone this last weekend. It was a beneficial trip to go. Amy's sister is still a bit rough. She will be for a while, but it was a good thing that we went. And it was a good thing to be able to encourage her. Also, I appreciate the thoughts on the loss of my grandfather. He was my last remaining grandparent, and without question, the one I was closest to, and without doubt, the most influential man besides my own father upon my life. You think I was extroverted? He would go to Walmart just to talk to people. But I learned a great many things from him. I didn't learn enough from him. And he'll be missed. But I appreciate your thoughts and your prayers. The songs that Jim led actually are very interesting this morning because they tie in very well to what I'm talking about this morning. The main topic today is why we can trust God. And I'd like to turn your attention to Hebrews chapter 11, verses 1 and 6. The thing is that many people in this world, including some very, very loud people who have written books, who are of influence, do not believe that God is alive. In fact, they don't even think he's dead. They, in fact, think there is no God. Hebrews 11:6, starting 11, verse 1, and then verse 6 say, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And without faith, verse 6, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists, and that he rewards those who seek him." Faith is a very interesting word nowadays because many people do not believe it means what it actually means. A lot of people claim to live having no faith. Well, the thing is, who has flown recently? A few people. Who has flown ever? More people. Do or do not have faith in the jet engine? To an extent, right? You have faith in the pilots, at least. I better. If I don't, I might get off. You have faith in the pilot's training. You have faith in the mechanics of the jet engine. You have faith that they have made sure that engine can run, and the pilots know what they're doing, that they're rested, that they're not doing anything that might hinder their flying. You have faith in a lot of things. Why do we have that sort of faith? And I keep using that word on purpose. We have faith because of previous experiences. We have faith because of we know to an extent the training of the pilots. We know the physics of the engine. We know the physics of the wing, the Bernoulli principle. Anyone? Nah, never mind. Air pressure. No, I'm not getting into that. I'm not a physicist. I'm a preacher. I've joked before, there's a reason I didn't pursue a mathematics career. I became a preacher. The thing is, though, a lot of us don't think about faith that way. A lot of us just think, well, that's just common sense. And in fact, because especially that atheists nowadays have hijacked the word faith. There's a movement out there I've mentioned before. Actually, surprisingly, they call themselves the Four Horsemen of the New Atheist Movement, the New Atheists. Perhaps you've heard of the book The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, among others. Richard Dawkins says, "Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and to evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence." Let me read that last line again. He says, Richard Dawkins says, "Faith is the belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence." How does that strike you? He's basically calling anyone who has a belief in God, and this is specifically what the book is about, that you believe in fairy tales, that we believe in nothing, that we believe actually in spite of or even because there's no evidence. Because of this, then, what they do, what they have done, and by they, I specifically mean the new atheists, they have made an either-or statement about science and God. They have made people believe that either you accept anything and everything that science says, or you accept God, and that the two are completely and totally incompatible. Stephen Hawking has actually gone on board with this, and dare I compete with Stephen Hawking. But he says, because of gravity, in his book, The Grand Design, which is meant to inspire that, interesting, about the designer, but yet he disproves in his mind a god. He says in the book, because of the law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. I may not be Stephen Hawking by any means, but I do know enough to be able to say that nonsense, even from the words of great scientists, is still nonsense. The interesting thing about this movement is that they claim that atheism isn't a faith at all, but simply a lack of belief, which naturally leads to a worldview of naturalism and reductionism. Reductionism basically means that you start complicated and everything has to be brought down to something simple. There's actually a funny moment. Peter Singer, who is an avowed atheist, an ethicist, and a physicist, debated Professor John Lennox, who is a mathematician but also an apologist. Christian apologist. Peter Singer said, no, atheism is not a faith at all. It's a lack of faith. And John Lennox said, well, don't you believe it? He didn't get an answer. The thing is, for many people, this set of problems lays out an interesting problem regarding faith. The main issue being that they do not understand what faith is. Faith is not a lack of evidence, but quite the opposite, as a matter of fact. This is our verse. Faith is having the assurance of things hoped for, the convictions of things not seen. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists. It's important. And also that He rewards those who seek Him. Also, what I find interesting to go along with this are statements like John 20:30-31, that many things that Jesus did and did not do were not written in this book, but these things were written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Son of God and the Bible is the Word of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. The Bible itself addresses these things, these accusations of what faith is or isn't, by saying there's evidence. But regardless, sometimes people have had the Bible now for 2,000 years, and many, many people believe it. Actually, probably more people don't believe it than do. And so, what I want to do this morning, Paul, last week, actually, by the way, who went and adjusted their crockpots whenever he said that it was going to be a short sermon? I texted him when I listened to it and said, that's one of the best lines about my sermon lengths I've ever heard. Anyway. He introduced this series as a series on apologetics. And actually, I wasn't planning on doing that, but since he said that, I thought I would delve into it a little bit this sermon and give you a taste of what Christian apologetics can be, but also, hopefully, end on a note which we can all very much relate to. And the subject matter is why we can indeed trust God. The thing is, when it comes to faith, this is the thing that I have seen among debates and scholarly essays and such, is the hardest thing to convince people of. Faith is not blind evidence. Or blind faith. Blind faith is leaping off a cliff going, I know something will save me. Kind of like the Wile E. Coyote thing. You know, he holds the sign up and goes, help! And then drops, and somehow he still survives. That's blind faith. The thing is about faith, and many of you recognize this graphic, is that it begins with facts, which lead then to actions. All of which, both of those which, and those are comprehensive to the nth degree, facts and actions that come from that, all those, and there's many of them, lead to an individual trust in the hope that the facts present. This is faith. Not blind faith, not believing in nothing or in spite of nothing or because there's nothing, but first beginning with facts. And in fact, when it comes to facts, we can use things like logic and reasoning to debate claims against God. As I said, I am not Stephen Hawking. But for instance, let's take this law of gravity statement that he made. The law of gravity versus God. First of all, he claims that you can either accept one or the other. Second of all, when he makes this statement, because of gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. That's a contradictory statement, first of all. Many people can't even believe that Hawking would even write that. Second graders will get that. Because what it does, when you talk about, this is talking about the law of cause and effect. Basically, you have to say, in order to count for the existence of Z, you have to have something that began, X, that created something, Y, which equals then Z. This isn't too complicated, it's just following along. Because X was there, it created Y, which then equaled up in Z. Basically, what Stephen Hawking is saying is that we can presuppose X to count for the existence of X because of X. We can count for the existence of the universe because of the universe, because of the law of gravity, which didn't exist in the first place. This seems confusing, because it is. Because it's a very, very weird statement, and it makes no logical sense. Basically, he's saying, because there is nothing, but there was a law of gravity, which isn't nothing, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing to account for itself. Read the Grand Design. He defends this to the hilt. And while we're not physicists, as I said, we can still recognize illogical nonsense. The thing is, what they're doing, what Hawking is doing, what Dawkins is doing, what people who want to use this against God is that they're confusing something very important. They're confusing a mechanism. They're confusing something that is happening and doing something with a creator. Let's explain this a little bit like this, and maybe you'll understand. Basically, if I were to ask you, how does a jet engine work? Some of you might know, some of you might not. But then I say, the only way you can explain a jet engine is to either choose the laws of combustion or Frank Whittle, who invented the jet engine. Do you see the contradictory statements? Either you can explain it by using the creator, or you can explain it using the laws of combustion. Anyone worth our salt would be like, that makes no sense. But some might say, well, I don't know how a jet engine works. Okay, well, let's explain something interesting, something else. Dave, explain how a car works choosing only the laws of combustion or Henry Ford. What say you? Say, I can't do it. It takes both. Dave gets it. Same and same. Let's try one more. Explain to me a pie only using the physical characteristics and chemical codes of the ingredients. You can't. These examples illustrate three things to us, which is exactly what Hawking is doing and Dawkins is doing. They tell us, one, you cannot pick only one side of a whole complete story. Two, and this is interesting too, none of these either ors explain where the materials came from. In order to create a jet engine, even if it's by the laws of combustion, you need something to work with. You need ingredients to make a pie. Regardless of how it's made or how, you still need materials to make a pie. And perhaps the most interesting one, why did you make this pie? The laws of science and the laws of physics and the laws of chemical, whatever, baking cannot explain purpose. Only a creator can.
That's right.
You can explain the nature of the pie using all the ingredients, how they form together, what happens. Anyone watch like Good Eats with Alton Brown? He goes into exactly why the ingredients work and how they interact with each other. It's fascinating. But the thing is, you can have 1,005 pies and have no idea why they're there. And you will never know why they're there until the baker says so. Here's the thing. This is why I mentioned before the term, it's a big word, reductionism, basically making everything go from complex to simple, does not work and cannot work. If you were to go to the beach and you were to see your name written, Brian, if you went and you saw BRYA and then kind of trailed off, or if you saw something like this, I found this picture, I didn't do it, but I had to use it because it says Ola Thomas. When you find this, you do not, no one in this world would assume, oh, this is amazing because of the laws of gravity and because of the laws of cohesion with the sand and the rocks and everything. Wow, it's amazing that everything formed at just the right moment to make this word. Who would think that? Immediately, what does our mind go to? It goes up to intelligence. It goes up to a mind. It goes back to a purpose behind it. If I saw this, I wouldn't go, wow, nature's cool. I would go, who's around here who knows me? Are they following me? I would immediately go up. I would immediately go from complex to more complex because that's the nature of what this says. The funny thing is that anyone in this world, if they saw that on the beach, would assume there was an intelligence and a creator behind it, except whenever they go and they find the 3.5 billion letter long word that makes up our DNA, everything perfectly formed, everything in its spot, if even one was wrong, it would fall apart, they immediately think chance. It takes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 letters to think of a reason and a mind and a creator, except 3.5 billion equals chance. This makes no sense, people. One thing that's also interesting about science and about their reasoning is that I wonder if scientists even think why their science works. You see, scientists are dependent on the laws of gravity, on the laws of combustion, on the laws of fill in the blank. And they actually have faith that the laws are constant, which even allows them to do their science in the first place. However, have we ever thought that it's not the laws themselves that do anything? It's not the law of gravity that does anything. Just because there's a law of gravity does not mean that a bowling ball will automatically roll down the lane and strike pins. Even though that's what causes it, what allows it to happen, it won't do it on its own. There has to be a catalyst, an instigator, a creator of first the bowling ball and the pins and the lane, and then something to set it in motion for it to go down. Just because there's a law that says this happens does not tell you anything about the situation. We depend on the law of gravity and the law of mass and force and distance to bowl. But it is not because of the law of gravity that we bowl, nor is it the law of gravity that makes things go bowl. The thing is, Romans 1:20 says, "For His," meaning God, "His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made." So they who don't believe in a God are without excuse. It's been here for 2,000 years. If you ever read Principia Mathematica, Isaac Newton's book on mathematics, I should have known Brian had. When Isaac Newton discovered the law of gravity, he didn't go, "Oh, I understand gravity. I don't need God." What he did was actually write Principia Mathematica in the hopes that this discovery of a law would convince people more about God. Instead of saying, "I don't need God anymore or understand something," he said, "Isn't it amazing how God has made this universe to function? Isn't it a clever God who would make gravity? This is cool." He didn't go the other way. The interesting thing about laws is that laws need lawgivers. And we need intelligence to explain why. Science alone cannot do it. Physics alone cannot do it. There's actually a story from John Langless again. He teaches at Oxford College in Cambridge, in England. And he was sitting down at dinner, and his dinner mate was an avowed atheist and reductionist and physicist. And he asked Lennox a few questions and found out that he was a Christian and an apologist. And he said, "Oh, we're going to have a horrible time. This is going to be a horrible dinner," which is a lovely way to start out a conversation. But they got into the debate. And Lennox said, "You're a reductionist. You believe everything can be broken down into science and mathematics." And he said, the gentleman said, "Yes." And Lennox said, "Let's do an experiment. And I'll translate it to here for this, but this is where this comes from. On this piece of paper, I see engine, E-N-G-I-N-E, six words. Here's the experiment. Explain to me how I know what that means using only the physical characteristics of the paper and ink. Anyone? Explain to me how that word has meaning using only the physical things of this piece of paper and the ink. If you're trying to figure out, spoiler alert, you can't do it." And that gentleman, who had been a physicist for 40 years, actually said he had been going into his lab for 40 years thinking that that could be done. And it was only recently he finally came to the conclusion, although he did not think God was real, that that cannot be done without an intelligence. The thing is then, once science and scientists, I'm not saying science is bad, I think science is along with Isaac Newton, I think science explains things about our world that we can go, "Wow, this is amazing." But where it becomes bad is when it becomes scientism, the belief that science answers everything. Because then people will go, "Well, if you can't explain it, we shouldn't be able to understand it." For instance, someone explain to me how Jesus can be God and human at the same time. Have you ever gotten that question before? Anyone run from that question before? Called your preacher? I haven't gotten a call yet, but I'm available. Here's a question for you, and you can use. Do you believe in consciousness? Do you believe in having some sort of awareness and this thing inside which makes us alive and real? Everyone will say yes. Can you explain that? This is interesting too. If you ask a physicist, "What is energy?" they might be tempted to say, "Well, we can measure it and use it, and it does this," and go, no. What is it? Scientists have no idea. Google this. They have no idea what it actually is, but they know how to use it and control it and manifest it. But what it is, they have no idea. They know it's there, and they believe in it, and use it, and depend on it, even though they cannot explain it. Does that sound familiar? This kind of thinking may not be everyone's cup of tea. However, hopefully, you're going, this is kind of neat. But the thing is, this may not be everyone's cup of tea, this may not be everyone's way of thinking. And this is only a glimpse into apologetics. It comes from the Greek word apologia, which means to make a defense of. The thing is, we haven't even gotten into the historical evidence for Jesus and the resurrection. We haven't even gotten into the history of how Christianity became a quick rising religion, quicker than almost anything. That just doesn't happen. And there's reasons for that. We haven't even gotten into the amount of evidence for the New Testament being verifiable and agreeing with itself, which is actually heads and tails over almost any other historical document out there. We haven't even gotten into how a book, a library that was written over the course of 2,000 years by several different authors agrees with itself, when it should have no reason to. When people wrote and they had no idea someone else was writing and they agree. We can't even get into that. We haven't even gotten into prophecy fulfillment. We haven't even gotten into archaeology. We haven't even gotten into most things which prove the Bible. And yet, I'm convinced. But here's the thing also, which is hard for people to accept until they've been there. We know that a relationship with God is not just facts and figures and logic and reasoning. We know that a relationship with God is much, much more than that. We know that God is real because we have experienced what it's like to pray and to have prayers answered. We can trust God because we've experienced the peace and comfort that only He can give when we have been in situations that there should be no reason for us to be peaceful and comforted by. We know He's real. We can trust Him because those of us who have sought it have experienced a journey of faith and growing in the fruit of the Spirit. Of love, of joy, of peace, patience, kindness, goodness. Those of us who have sought it have experienced a yearning, a longing for God, and have found it in the God of the Bible. 15 years ago, on this day, I doubt there were any atheists in New York. I doubt there were any atheists on the plains. I doubt there was any atheists because, actually, if you go to New York, and I haven't, and if you listen to the testimonies of people affected by the tragedy of September 11th, you will find many, many thankful prayers, gracious hearts to God, questions of why He would allow this, but yet the fruit of His working in people's lives, evident in people seeking the comfort that rises above this world and the knowledge of peace that this world can't provide. It's interesting, when disasters happen, you don't really find too many people crying out for Darwin. Nor do you find many people trying to convince the world to spare them. The famous saying goes, there are no atheists in foxholes. Now, is this proof, per se? Well, it depends on your perspective. Ask someone who has never experienced faith versus someone who only recovered from addiction by faith. Ask someone who got divorced when it was easy versus someone who through prayer and Bible study and seeking how to be a husband saved his marriage. Ask someone who has gone and experienced something horrible and just been told, suck it up, buttercup, versus someone who is in a car wreck and lost everyone, but yet found comfort in God. Is it relative? Maybe a little. But it depends on your word for proof. Do you seek mathematical proof, which only exists in mathematics? Or do you seek the kind of proof which is, well, the best we have, which is beyond reasonable doubt? We can trust God, as I stand before you today, because there is evidence that Jesus came to this world, lived a life, died and rose from the grave, sent His Spirit on Pentecost, and has been working in that way ever since. We can trust God because in people's lives, when there should have been no reason that they did what they did. We can trust God because His invisible attributes, you look outside and you see the stars. And it takes a hard heart to say, well, that beauty is all by chance. We can trust God because there is evidence beyond reasonable doubt that He is real. In fact, I would challenge you this, and anyone who comes to me with this, I would claim it takes more faith to be an atheist, to believe that nothing came out of nothing and then it exploded and something happened, to believe that our minds, who can feel love and peace and joy and sadness and kindness and work in this way, is the result of simply an unguided process that happened to assemble in this way. If that's the case, how can you trust your own reasoning? I think it takes more faith to be an atheist than it does to be a believer in God. And therefore I ask you this question for you to be left with. In your life, would you agree or disagree that there is, beyond reasonable doubt, proof that there is a God? Maybe it may be in your own life. Maybe in someone else's life. It might be the way that I was converted, which was through evidences. It just made sense. If you believe that, grow in that. Find out everything we can about it. Find out how to make these arguments. Find out the basis and the foundation of how this book was assembled. And if you're struggling with that, ask yourself this one question. Do I want to find out why I am? Do I want to find out why this world? Do I want to find out why? Because there's only one thing that can answer that for you. And His name is God. Hopefully, I've stretched your mind a little bit. Hopefully, I've made you think. And hopefully, you can walk away from here either curious or hopefully more engaged with why, some basic reasons why we can trust God. We haven't even touched how to yet. Keep in mind, there's reasons we can trust God. Not the least which because He's real. Not just because I say so. And not because Stephen Hawking says He's not. But because it takes more faith to be an atheist than it does to believe that there is a God who loves you and cares for you and knows who you are. I'll leave you with that as we stand and sing.